You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because... I have a charcoal mask. Great, because why would I put that on my face when I could drop it in my sink? This is what I get for multitasking. Ugh, why is charcoal so sticky?
Hello?
Hey, Janice. I am so sorry. I thought I was on mute. No, we don't need to reschedule. I'll just stay off camera. Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
Betraying the Nobel, the secrets and corruption behind the Nobel Peace Prize. I couldn't believe, when I was talking to Uni Turrettini, who wrote the book Betraying the Nobel, I couldn't believe in how many stories she had about Nobel Peace Prize winners being they should be like a Nobel genocide winner in some cases, or Nobel War Prize winners, but there is no Nobel War Prize. So Betraying the Nobel, hold on to your seats, because there's a lot of stories that I did not know about some of these Nobel Peace Prize winners. Jay's recommendation. I just started watching the show Ragnarok. I started last night, Jay.
Do you like it?
Yeah, it's good.
The premise is like, you know, the giant in the Norse.
Don't tell me anything, because they haven't mentioned anything yet.
Okay. I'm not going to say anything.
I'm only on like the beginning of episode two.
Right. So, yeah.
Uni, are you from Norway originally?
I am. Yes, I am. I am Norwegian. I lived abroad for most of my adult life. So more than 20 years. But then moved back to Oslo after all that time almost 5 years ago.
Where do you live when you lived 20 years abroad?
I lived in the US, I lived in France and Switzerland.
First off, why'd you go from US to France? That seems like a step backwards. No, I'm just kidding.
Actually a little bit.
Okay, good.
I was a little bit back and forth between France and the US. The first time I went abroad and lived abroad was an exchange student in high school.
Oh, okay.
So I was, barely turned 17. And they sent me to, my program sent me to Kansas City, Kansas.
Oh, so it's
of all places.
You really hit the most exciting spot of the US.
You know, yeah.
I actually always use Kansas City as an example because I do think it's probably nice in Kansas City. I've never been there. You could tell me differently, but it seems like it's the middle of America. Like it's the exact center of America. And I don't know, it's probably representative of the whole middle America area. Well, what did you think of Kansas City?
You know what? I had a really good time. Kansas City is actually a really beautiful city. And people are really friendly and nice. And I had a wonderful host family. So I actually had a really good time. And it was interesting too, because I don't think I would have chosen to go to Kansas City or, you know, in the middle of America. You know, I thought, you know, I kind of was hoping for, you know, dreaming of California and the beaches and the nice weather and the palm trees. But I'm actually glad they sent me there, because then I really got to live and experience the real America, really. The place, you know, the places where people don't usually go to as tourists.
You know, I was once at this business networking dinner, and I was sitting next to this guy who had, like, you know, he was a tall guy. He was wearing a nice, crisp suit. He had he was older, but he had a thick head of white hair, or whitish, grayish hair. And he was talking like just such a nice, honest guy. And so smooth. He was like, oh, you should move to Kansas. You can get like an 8-bedroom house for, you know, $0. And I said to him, you know, you're so enthusiastic about Kansas and you seem like a good guy and you should run for governor. And he's like, well, I am the governor of Kansas. So it's a nice place where just everybody's accessible. So
yeah.
And then now you're back in Norway though. Is this your home for life?
So now it's, well, I don't know if it's for life. I don't like to talk in absolutes. But for now, we're good here. So my husband is Swiss and you know, our kids were born in Switzerland and are half Swiss, half Norwegian.
Now, when they argue with you, are they like totally neutral on everything? Like they have no opinion? Because they're Swiss?
Oh, no, I mean, they're very opinionated, yeah. I think they probably got that from me. My husband is more diplomatic,
yes,
the Swiss.
So, okay, well, you're clearly not diplomatic, by the way, after reading your book, Betraying the Nobel, The Secrets and Corruption Behind the Nobel Peace Prize. And it's great that you wrote this because I've even been thinking, you know, you hear stories here and there, like, and then you see, oh, this person won the Nobel Peace Prize. And you're like, what? I'm thinking specifically, I remember reading a few years ago, Barack Obama was hosting this woman who had won the Nobel Peace Prize from Myanmar. And then she's like this genocidal politician. Once she kind of, after her accolades of winning the Nobel Peace Prize, she starts running the country. And it's literally a shit show there. Like, it's sad what's happening there.
Yeah.
And then you wonder everything, like, what is going on with the Peace Prize? Why did the U.S. host her? Like, and I just didn't want to dive down that rabbit hole because there's no point. But not only did you dive down the rabbit hole with her, but with every single Peace Prize winner, you really took Alfred Nobel's, you know, last will and testament and what he intended for the Peace Prize, and really like translated it literally to understand who should win and why. But the first thing is, why is there a peace prize? Alfred Nobel, however you say his name, he created the instruments of war, dynamite. What happened then?
It's, you know what? It's actually a really interesting story. He's a fascinating man, this Alfred Nobel, who invented dynamite. He passed away in 1896. He was 63 years old. So he died pretty young.
Can I ask
he
a quick question? So dynamite is very volatile. So when you say he invented dynamite, I can't imagine getting like a bag of very volatile explosives and somehow baking it into a stick and living.
Yeah. No, so what he did, he took nitroglycerin and he basically made it safe enough to be able to use it for infrastructure, you know, building roads and tunnels and that sort of thing. So he didn't, you know, so it's not correct to say that he invented, he renamed, you know, nitroglycerin after he had made it safe enough. So he made up the name then, or he called it, you know, after Dynamis, the Greek god.
He didn't use a Norse god?
He didn't use a Norse god, no.
but how did he make it safer? I mean, in order to make it safer, you kind of have to handle it, right? Like, how come he didn't blow up while figuring this out?
Well, he did a lot of time. There were a lot of explosions, you know, when he was developing this. And it took a few years for him to be able to make it safe enough. And even his younger brother died in one of the explosions. And that was really devastating to Alfred Nobel.
And so then he dies at the age of 63. Did he start to realize that, hey, people are buying this, but for the wrong reasons?
No, so I think what happened was Alfred Nobel actually had a lot of different inventions, but he's most famous for dynamite. And he was a brilliant businessman as well. And he created this empire and he was one of the wealthiest persons at the time, when he was living. And he had all his money, but his personal life was kind of sad. So he was all alone. He fell in love twice in his life. Once when he was younger and that woman died. And then he fell in love with this other woman. He was around 43 years old. And he hired this woman called Bertha as a personal assistant. But really, he was looking for a wife. And so the personal assistant thing was kind of an excuse. And Bertha was this this intelligent young woman. She was actually working as a governess for this rich family, you know, basically a nanny for this rich family in Vienna, Austria. And she came from this very noble, aristocratic background, but her family didn't have enough money, so she had to work for a living. So this is why I often call the Nobel Peace Prize, it's actually kind of a love story, in my view, because Alfred hired her, and she had actually been sort of forced to apply for the job to be Alfred Nobel's assistant by the Foot and Suit Nurse. So the family she was working for, the mother, she wanted to send her away because she fell in love with the eldest son in the Von Suttner family. So, of course, that didn't go down well with the Von Suttner family. So they sent her away, sent her to work for Alfred Nobel. And he quickly realized that he had fallen in love with her.
Uh-oh.
And, of course, the feelings were not mutual. So she packed her stuff, left, went back to Austria, and eloped with the Von Suttner son. And but she and Alfred actually kept in touch. They remained friends over the years. And Bertha von Suttner would actually become this front figure for the peace movement in Europe. And she wrote a book that became a bestseller called Lay Down Your Arms. And so before Alfred died, he sent her his last will. And in the last will, of course, he had, you know, he had given all his money to these five prizes, and among them the Peace Prize. And because of the wording and the things that he said in his last will, it's such an obvious declaration of love to Bertha von Suttner. And she did win the Nobel Peace Prize. She was the first woman to win the prize
after his death
in 1905. After his death.
Yeah, because yes. He died in 1896. So the first prizes were in 1905?
The first prize was given in 1901, and then she won it in 1905.
Because I remember reading in your book that the Peace Prize, he doesn't specify, it doesn't have to be given every year, even though it is given every year now. But it wasn't necessarily given every year, I guess, in the beginning. Why, and you talk about this in the book, but why Norway when all the other prizes are awarded in Sweden?
Yeah, Alfred Nobel never specified. He never explained to anyone why he gave the Peace Prize to Norway. But if we can take an educated guess, just looking at the history at the time, Norway was in union with Sweden when Alfred Nobel died. And after having been passed, sort of just given by Denmark to Sweden 100 years earlier. So Norway basically had not been independent for more than 500 years. And so Norway didn't have its own foreign ministry or foreign policy. And the, you know, it had not been a military power since the Vikings. So it's probable that Alfred Nobel saw Norway as this tiny, innocent nation on the periphery of Europe, not at all involved in you know, politics and power games. And perhaps he felt that the Peace Prize would be safer given out by the Norwegian government than Sweden.
So basically, they were all Vikings, right? Norway and Sweden?
Yeah.
So, okay. Nobel Peace Prize given out by the Vikings. It's a good balance in history. Why does anyone care about the Nobel Prize? Like, how did it, like if I set up the James Altucher Prize in physics and peace, no one's going to care. Was it like that much money back then in 1905 that everybody cared or, and there was no other prizes like this? Because there are plenty of prizes now for all these different categories.
Back then it was unusual. Mm-hmm. It was unusual for someone to give away basically all their money to a cause. And it certainly got a lot of attention in the media, in the press. There were a lot of controversy around it. The Swedish king really opposed and tried to undo the will, and to, especially when it came to the Peace Prize, to send all that money outside of Sweden. And so it did get a lot of attention. I think also it got a lot of attention because of Alfred Nobel and who he was, and because he was, in a way, such a celebrity at the time.
So he was a celebrity in his life. Like, everybody knew him as this big industrialist and and well-regarded and so on. And then was there ever controversy, even in the beginning, that, again, dynamite was used so much for war, and here he is having a peace prize and science prizes and so on. Like, when did that controversy kind of start, or was there ever a controversy with it?
Well, a lot of people still think today that the Nobel Prizes were established sort of out of guilt to compensate for dynamite. Because, of course, dynamite is dangerous, and it has been used not only to build roads and railroads, but also, you know, for terrorism. But when we look at the history and Alfred Nobel and how proud he was of all of his inventions, including especially dynamite, I should say, and also, you know, it's not true that he created this out of guilt. He actually saw dynamite as a way to improve life for all of us, for human, you know, for the betterment of the world and for humans. So he, and also this was confirmed to me by Michael Nobel, who is the great, great, what would he be? He would be, so he was the descendant of one of Alfred Nobel's brothers. Mm. And he's still alive today.
And it's interesting. So with the Peace Prize, so now you wrote this book, Betraying the Nobel, and it's all about the Nobel Peace Prize. Why did you decide to focus on the Peace Prize? Because as I don't know, I think you've been on Brian Keating's podcast, who wrote Losing the Nobel. There's a lot of controversy around physics, for instance. There's a lot of controversy around other categories. It's also a controversy around categories that he didn't include. Like, why didn't he include mathematics, for instance, or other sciences? But what focused you on the Peace Prize?
For me, it really was the fact that it's Norway, my home country, that gives out this prize. And, you know, growing up in Norway, I was always extremely proud of the Peace Prize and the fact that my, you know, home country and this tiny country in the world, I felt that it gave us importance as a country, as a people. And that was also why I was so curious. For me, this whole journey of researching, digging into the Peace Prize and the history started in 2009 when they gave the Peace Prize to Barack Obama. Because I remember that it was just so curious that they would, because to me, you know, what the little I knew about the last will and the Nobel Peace Prize back then was that it has, you know, it was supposed to reward a person on what they had already achieved.
And technically, wasn't supposed to reward a person who achieved something in the last year.
Yeah, in the last year. That they hardly ever...
In any category, they never do
it. It's more of a... More often, it's a sort of a lifetime reward for all the good that you've done in you know, in your life.
And Barack Obama, I remember, and you kind of mentioned this in the book, that he almost was embarrassed by it. Like, he hadn't even taken the office of presidency yet, and they were already giving him the Nobel Peace Prize. And there was so much issue, they kind of even had to make a statement that this is for the hope of what he can do and what he represents, as opposed to what he's done.
Yeah. That's what they said afterwards, you know, later on. But in the announcement, when they announced the Peace Prize, they actually said that, you know, it's for all the good that, you know, he had done. But then at the press conference, I remember there were an American journalist asking, so what specifically has he done in the previous year, since he has only been president for roughly 8 months when he was announced the winner, and when he was nominated for the prize, he had been president for, I think, less than 2 weeks. Mm.
And so... I think it's very hard for a U.S. president ultimately to get a Lifetime Peace Achievement Award because, you know, the U.S. has basically been at war since forever. And that means the president has to make decisions where civilians die. And, you know, some presidents make worse decisions than others. And you could argue maybe it's always a bad decision when civilians die. But like, do you think people, I mean, and this is not really a political discussion, like Barack Obama sent more troops here or there, or maybe pulled troops out from other places, but it's not like he ended a war, and it's not like he brought any additional peace more or less than any other U.S. president.
Yep.
I mean, maybe less war than W, who started a bunch of wars, but you know, what happened? Do you think he feels that he deserved it, or do you think the Peace Prize, they regret it a little bit? Or I'm not saying anything bad about him. It's just that clearly he was involved in a lot of wars, like any president.
Yeah. And that's the what's so interesting, and what I found when I started digging into it, is that, you know, and when at the press conference, when they announced the prize to Obama, the reward to Obama, the chairman finally said, you know, when pressed for answers, he said, "We want to send a signal to the world." So that was why they gave. So I was wondering, so what is the signal? And then as I was digging into it, I found all these political motivations behind, you know, many of the rewards. Not all of them, of course. Some of them are good and in line with what Alfred Nobel wanted, but just a lot of them are politically motivated. And the Obama Prize, which was actually the last in a row of prizes that were not given to people because they deserved it, but actually as a slap in the face of George W. Bush and his administration. Mm. And what really surprised me was the arrogance of the committee, because they're so arrogant. They think that they can do whatever they want and that nobody is supervising them, that they can just do whatever they want. And they even say this as justification for some of the awards, that this is, you know, this the prize this year. And this started in 2001, right after George W. declared war on terrorism and decided to go to war on terrorism without first going through the UN. So that year, they gave the Peace Prize to the UN and Kofi Annan, who had strongly given his opinion against US going to war without first, you know, asking and going through the UN. In 2002, they gave the award to President Carter, Jimmy Carter. And that year, they actually said it at the Peace Prize ceremony, that this year, of course, Jimmy Carter deserves the prize, but that's not why we're giving it to him. We're giving it to him as, they called it, a kick in the leg, which is directly translated from Norwegian, and it means a slap in the face. They gave it as a slap in the face to George W. Bush and his administration for going to war against terrorism without first, you know, asking or going to the UN.
I mean, there's a lot to unpack here, because you have a lot of stuff in here too about the UN. Like, the UN has all these quote unquote peacekeeping services, but why didn't they stop? And I always wonder this. Everybody cares about what's happening in the Middle East, and of course that's important, but why didn't anybody lift a finger to stop the Rwandan genocide? Everybody knew it was happening. The UN peacekeeping officers were right there. The troops were right there, and they were causing part of the problem. And then how does the UN win the... Everybody knew this, and that was in 1993 or 94. Why did the UN ever win the Nobel Peace Prize?
It's a great question. And Kofi Annan was actually in charge of Rwanda, and, you know, the commission in Rwanda during the genocide. And he has later apologized. He did apologize because he didn't report, or he didn't take seriously the reports that he received about the possibility of a genocide. And so
I'm sorry to interrupt, but how could he not just know that this was happening? Like, we would know if something like that was happening in our country. You would know, I would know, we would all know.
It's, you know, and again, I think politics enter the equation about sort of an unwillingness to, you know, France had interests in Rwanda. And actually, I believe the French government is now is officially apologizing for their part in the genocide because they were actually helping.
I mean, it was so horrible, though. Yeah. How could you can't even? I mean, maybe they feel apologies protect them from judgment, but it just doesn't. Like, that was one of the most horrible events in history, among many that were awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. And these people, I particularly blame Kofi Annan because he must his forces were right there helping in some cases. Yeah. He absolutely knew. So either they, and I don't want to accuse him of anything, but either they paid him off or he knew he would be Secretary General of the UN because he turned away somehow. I don't know.
Yeah. I also think it has to do with some of the unsuccessful UN commissions in other countries like Somalia and a couple of other places as well, where the conflict just lasted for years and years and years and costing so much money, and the member countries were kind of fed up of all these conflicts where the UN were unsuccessful in stopping. So it's not only Kofi Annan, but I think it was also on the part of the member countries in the Security Council, an unwillingness to should we get involved in yet another conflict that will just drain our resources and not lead to anything. So I think it has to do with that as well.
Do you think the UN? Do you think their peacekeeping services? Whatever you call them, they're peacekeeping troops. Do you think they ever kept the peace anywhere? And I'm not asking this sarcastically. I honestly don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I do think they have done a good job sometimes. Mm-hmm. But then again, the peacekeeping troops are only as good as the people that each country send. So when these troops, these people go to these foreign countries and they start, abusing children and traffic women and do drugs and all these, horrific things that happens, then for sure they're not doing their job. And it's difficult because the UN is not a country. So there is not one institution in charge of all these troops. It's really they are managed by each country sending them.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It's very complicated.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a 3-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, of course, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a 3-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours. And they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now you could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop. Really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because...
Hey, listen. Remember how you told me to toss those takeout containers before we left for vacation? And you were like, I'm serious. If that leaks over the counter, it'll be a slimy abomination by the time I get back. And I was like, yeah. Of course. Don't worry about it. I won't forget. Well...
Ooh, yeah. That happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed. Rinse after use if in contact with food surface.
You know, the other thing in this 2002 or 3 award is arguably Jimmy Carter, whether or not people like him as a president. I mean, there's a lot of factors towards being a president, but he did this enormous thing, bring Israel and for the first time, a Muslim country, Egypt, together, Sadat and Begin. And, you know, as you mentioned in the book, he kind of deserved it then, but they forgot to apply for him until like the day after the deadline. It's like applying to college or something, applying for the Nobel Peace Prize. And so do you think, who do you, other than Carter or maybe include Carter, but what president in the United States do you think ever deserved the Nobel Peace Prize?
That is I'm not actually sure that any of them would have deserved the Peace Prize on their own. What I read in my book as well is that they tend to reward American presidents throughout history. And this is from the beginning of, you know, from the very first awards to it's in the interest of the Norwegian government and Norwegian foreign policy as a, you know, strengthening ties with the United States. You know, as Norway was leaving Sweden and becoming independent, you know, way back, you know, at the very beginning, You know, we see that Norway is trying to strengthen, trying to become this stronger state, and is, you know, of course, afraid that they will be, you know, forced to be governed by Denmark or Sweden again. And so they are seeking west, and they're seeking to the UK and the United States. So there's a rewards going to the US solely for that reason.
So I get that with everybody wants the US to like them. US has the most money. And yeah. If we keep giving the president the Nobel Peace Prize, we'll get more money from them. It's like an economic thing. But what's the story with this Myanmar woman who basically was peaceful and now leads a genocide?
Well, Aung San Suu Kyi, she actually deserved the prize when she was rewarded. I believe it was in 1991. She was then a prisoner of Myanmar, and she was standing for democracy. She was fighting through peaceful means. And so she was absolutely worthy, a worthy winner back then. But then when things turned around and she was able to lead Myanmar because the military, you know, basically gave way to try democracy. Then she turned around and she completely almost forgot what she was fighting for in the first place. And she allowed, and it also believed that maybe she did allow this genocide against the Rohingya, the Muslim Rohingyas, so that she would, you know, be reelected in, you know, last year in 2020, and that the military also would allow her to continue being in power. So there was definitely a power game there. But of course, you know, these are just excuses, you know, for allowing genocide to happen. But what's curious is that the Nobel Peace Prize Committee hasn't, even if they didn't make a mistake back in 1991 when they first rewarded her, they haven't rescinded the prize, as all the other, you know, she won numerous prizes from Amnesty International, and I believe also the U.S. Congress Freedom Prize, and all of these prizes have been rescinded. But the Nobel Peace Prize, the committee, are refusing to even discuss the matter. And they have just said, you know, for other prizes as well, that they will never rescind the prize.
I wonder why, because that really shows influence when you could have the threat of rescinding a prize. I mean, not that people will pay attention to that necessarily, but they might a little bit. And it might bring awareness to what's happening right now in places like Myanmar. I only use that as an example, but you give many stories in the book similar to that. Well, and one area where it's very interesting, I wasn't sure if I agreed with you or not, but Malala obviously is a very interesting story. You know, maybe describe that story and what your focus was on that.
So to me, Malala is one of the what I call celebrity prices, and she, you know, she was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize already in 2013. She didn't receive it then, and then in 2014 they gave it to her, and I think there was a lot of pressure and a lot of nominations for her to win the Nobel Peace Prize. And it was a popular prize to give. Malala, you know, we're all, the whole world, we were so touched by her story. And they do that. The committee does that quite often.
It's like a feel-good prize.
It's a feel-good prize, exactly. And, you know, and first of all, her prize, her work is human rights, standing up for women's rights and girls' rights for education worldwide. That actually falls outside of the scope of Alfred Nobel's last will. So they have actually just expanded the scope of the last will without asking anyone's permission, without going through proper legal channels.
And this is where I was unsure. Mm-hmm. Like maybe describe what is the scope of, you know, what was Alfred Nobel's intention? Because I think she's on the border a little bit. Although I agree that I might not call it a celebrity prize, but I would call it a symbolic prize because she wasn't, she's not an actual leader of anything to have the influence to really drive peace. But symbolically, she exposed in a very, unfortunately, very real personal way, the plight of women in some of these countries. And that, that has sort of is related to peace. You know, it deals with a significant part of the population, 50% of the world.
Yeah.
So,
and I agree with you. I believe that the definition in Alfred Nobel's will should be expanded, you know, to reflect our society today, because a lot of things have happened in the past 125 years. But the problem is that the committee, we never know what they're going to decide. There's no definition that we know of what it seems to be just a sort of a, sometimes on a whim that, oh, this year, we think this is a good cause, so we'll just call it peace. You know, that's what it seems like sometimes. But what Alfred Nobel wrote in his last will was that the winner shall be a champion of peace, having done the best work for fraternity between nations, the abolition or reduction of standing armies, and finally, for the holding and promotion of peace congresses. So we have basically three elements here. We have work, you know, for the brotherhood between nations. The second one is the abolition or reduction of standing armies. And finally, holding or promotion of peace congresses. Peace congresses are basically, you know, where people meet, you know, to demonstrate or to discuss and find, you know, peaceful means.
Does it have to be all three?
That's the thing. That also is up for discussion.
Because only a political leader will reduce armies, really, or a military leader, I guess. Although I guess someone who calls for the reduction of violence could be. So Malala, in that sense, called for the reduction of violence. And there were Congress, you know, meetings and conferences that dealt with her specific issues. So that's why I feel like she's a little on the border. Like, who do you think is the person who least deserved it, who got it? Oh, but also sometimes people who don't really deserve it do satisfy those three conditions. Like you talked about Henry Kissinger, and I agreed with your stance that he didn't deserve it. I mean, he drastically increased for a long time troops in Vietnam and so on. But at the end of his term, particularly under Ford, they ended the Vietnam War. And so you can argue he changed, or maybe he didn't change really, but he did satisfy those conditions.
Yeah. Well, what under Ford, that was after he received it.
You know? Okay.
So it was kind of a little late for the Peace Prize anyway. But yes, I do agree with you. I think, you know, there's definitely the Kissinger prize, and Kissinger shared that year's prize in 1973 with the leader of North Vietnam, Le Duc Tho. And Le Duc Tho actually refused to receive it because and rightly so.
He basically said, I'm a bloodthirsty tyrant.
There's still not peace in our region. So why are we receiving the Peace Prize? You know, the United States was carpet bombing Vietnam and that region, you know, while they were announcing the prize that year. And that was not a secret. So it's curious. And so Le Duc Tho, he actually refused to receive it. So I think that year is definitely egregious. I also
were they trying to maybe bring them together on the Norwegian stage to say, hey, now you guys are here, let's talk? You think they was trying to influence rather than reward?
Not that year. Mm-hmm. That year, it was definitely, you know, during the Cold War, 1973, Norway feeling threatened by Russia and wanting to, you know, stay close with the U.S.
Mm. Got it.
So that was, that was definitely the motivation that year. In 1994, it's an interesting prize also to, you know, for the Oslo, that was given for the Oslo Accords between Israel and Palestine. And they gave it to Yasser Arafat, Yitzhak Rabin, and Shimon Peres. And none of them can qualify as peace champions according to Alfred Nobel's last will. But I think perhaps, you know, Yasser Arafat is perhaps the least, you know, he basically was a terrorist and he didn't even, you know, the Peace Prize didn't even make him more peaceful. I mean, he showed up at the Peace Prize ceremony. He was armed, which is illegal in Norway. So they had to remove his gun.
It's so funny showing up. It's like a sitcom showing up for the Nobel Peace Prize with guns.
Yeah, exactly.
What if you had to like shoot people in the audience? Like what would have, hey, I'm here for the Peace Prize. Get out of my way. And he takes out his gun.
So that one. Another one, another prize that I find egregious, but this might be, you know, this is maybe just my opinion, but in 2006, they gave the Peace Prize to Muhammad Yunus for his
that was an
founder
interesting
of
chapter.
Microcredit. Yeah.
I always thought it was amazing what he did, but you mentioned in that chapter that very few people actually benefit from so Muhammad Yunus, for people who don't know, kind of developed this concept in Africa of microfinance, giving tiny loans, let's say to, you know, war-torn, widowed women who are starting businesses, giving these micro loans to help them start their businesses, and then they would pay them back. And it didn't really, you were pointing out, it didn't really work out.
Yeah, what they have found, you know, I think it looked really good in the beginning, in the first few years. And then when they started looking into what was really happening to the people, you know, in the years following, when after they had been given these microloans, is that they found that these people were not any better off, most of them. They were actually worse off because now they were caught in this debt trap and they had to go to loan sharks to be able to repay their microloans. And then they were, you know, caught, you know, with these, you know, loan sharks who demanded, you know, 100%
like interest a year.
Interest, exactly. Mm-hmm. Thank you. So it's and what we saw in several regions were suicide epidemics. You know, where people, where women especially, and it's just, you know, horrifying learning about it. How women would take their, you know, small kids and drown themselves and jump off a cliff and often even. Even, you know, they were kind of bullied even to take their own lives or to flee the town. Because the way these microloans work is that because they don't have any collateral, the banks, so what they do is that they have these groups of people coming together and they take up the loan together. So if one of these, let's say five women come together, take up a loan, each person get their money. And then if one of these women can't pay her weekly interest to the bank, then the rest of the group, the four other people, are responsible for paying for her. So it creates this enormous pressure, social pressure on people to repay their loans, even if they can't. And that's why they go to these loan sharks. And, you know, and even, there are stories about how the employees of Grameen Bank, which is the bank of Muhammad Yunus, how the employees there even, you know, they were yelling, screaming at these poor people who couldn't repay their weekly interests, you know, in weekly parts, and just basically bullying them into committing suicide. Encouraging them even to commit suicide. So it's really
why would they do that? Like, did they have life insurance on everybody they lent money to, or
they also had life insurance? Well, they actually forced people when they took up loans to also have all these sort of life insurance, you know, and all the other insurances. So the loans ended up costing them a lot more than it says on the initial paper. Yeah. And a lot of these people, a lot of these women that take up these loans, they don't even know how to read. So it's really just, you know, unfair conditions. And
has Muhammad Yunus ever spoken about this?
He has never spoken about this. No. And it's, he's, there was this Norwegian television program that did some research, and they tried to interview him, but he refused to comment.
So what do you think that is? Yeah. Like, people, obviously they want to protect their reputation,
yeah,
but it's okay to have a reputation of admitting you're wrong, but maybe that's a different type of reputation. Like, some people will applaud that and others will say, ah, you were wrong once, so we hate you forever.
Yeah.
So, but he could have maybe made a difference by, or he could still do it by admitting he's wrong, or maybe creating improvements to this. Although I don't know
absolutely
how you do that.
Yeah, and I think that applies to all leaders and all, you know, winners of Nobel Prizes and you know, any presidents or leaders anywhere. To, you know, we're all just human and we make mistakes. And if you can own your mistake and apologize, then I think we are prone to forgive. I mean, I know I am. I much rather have the Norwegian Prime Minister apologize for mistakes that she has made. That will increase my trust in her. When they don't apologize, when they don't take responsibility and own their mistakes, that's when trust erodes. That's when we, you know, and that creates a lot of problems and people who then go elsewhere for information and start, you know, looking into conspiracy theories and other things and extremism.
Yeah, yeah, good point. Like they lose trust in this.
Yeah.
I mean, the Nobel Prize is a very respected institution, maybe the most respected institution on the planet. Like, if you win the Nobel Prize in physics, that's your whole career, your whole industry. You're at the top. You're the alpha male of an entire industry. Or alpha female or whatever.
Yeah.
And, but the thing is, the Peace Prize, there's more at stake because, yeah, as you mentioned, it's, you, have you reduced armies? Have you created peace? Whereas, like, let's say physics, not to downplay innovations in physics, but pretty much every physicist is wrong by, proven wrong by future science. And it's fine. Like, that's what science is being skeptical of the last generation, whether it was last year or 20 years ago, or like Albert Einstein was wrong. He didn't develop the final theory of physics. Quantum mechanics came 20 years later. And then all of those people might be proven wrong at some point because there was a lot of Nobel physics prizes for that. So here's a question. Let's say the committee was for the Nobel Peace Prize was just you and me. Who would you nominate? I'm going to think of a nomination.
Who?
I have a good one.
Oh, you have a good one? Yeah.
Yeah, I'll tell mine first. So the remember Tiananmen Square? Remember the photo of the guy standing in front of the tank? I feel like, and then that photograph was portrayed around the world, and that put a lot of pressure on China to stop the killing that was happening there. Now he didn't reduce, he might have, you could even argue he reduced armies. So I'm going to throw him out there.
Yeah. Another good one. That's a good one. Another good one is Cora Weiss. Cora Weiss is this woman who started Women Strike for Peace. She has been leading peace movements since the early 1960s worldwide, but especially in the U.S. And she is, you know, she actually fulfills all three of Alfred Nobel's conditions in his last will.
And she's been nominated 4 times for the Nobel Peace Prize.
I believe even 5 times, what we know, 5 times she's been nominated. And she's still alive and kicking, and she's still, you know, working for peace through education, through, you know, all sorts of, you know, she's just a wonderful human being and such a worthy winner. But for some reason, she doesn't bring, and that's where I think that this celebrity thing also comes to mind, because she's not this glamorous winner. She's not Malala, who would bring all this fame and celebrity onto the Nobel Peace Prize and to Norway through the reward. There also there's this Japanese Buddhist leader called Daisaku Ikeda. I may be misspelling his name, but he has, you know, been a peace builder and writer and founded peace research institutions around the world and really it tries to inspire to peace through education and empathy and compassion. And I think when you're kind of like a silent leader like that, like Cora Wise as well, you just don't get the attention of the committee. Also, especially if they have a political agenda, someone who suits their needs, then they're not going to give it to you for sure.
Yeah, I'm quickly perusing him. He looks definitely interesting. You know, there's have you ever heard of this organization, Women for Women International?
No.
So it's basically a charity where, as opposed to what Muhammad Yunus does, they distribute direct aid to women who are widowed in wars like the Iran-Iraq war and other Middle Eastern wars, Afghanistan, Bosnia, and so on. And it was founded by a husband and wife team, and they were the wife was a survivor of the Iran-Iraq war. And I always think that's an interesting one. That, because, you know, and does it directly reduce armies and create peace? There's a saying, you know, if a country has two borders, I mean, if a country borders each other, then either bullets or money will go over those borders. So if you create kind of an economy, that reduces war. It creates more peace. And so I think that organization is always interesting. But okay,
yeah,
so these,
that's really interesting.
These are a lot of names that nobody knows. I wonder if there's kind of like a famous person who we could nominate in the Uni James Peace Prize.
While I'm thinking about that, I just want to add to what we said earlier about this whole trust issue in leaders and why it's so important that the Nobel Peace Prize makes good choices, because the Peace Prize winners are, you know, they become these role models for us, right? Or at least they could, or they're supposed to be the beacon of hope of leadership that we can aspire to. And I think we see that, especially in the U.S., what's happening, you know, last year with the election and also during COVID, when people don't trust the government, when people don't trust their leaders, they, you know, they go to other sources, and it's easy to fall into a rabbit hole of conspiracy theories and even, you know, going as far as extremism. And I believe this distrust in leadership that we see around around the globe, not only in the U.S. You know, we saw it in Hong Kong with the riots. Mm. You know, still I believe going on there, but especially before COVID in France. You know, the yellow vest movement there that was shut down by COVID. But you know, all this distrust around the world. And that creates a lot of social isolation, a lot of loneliness. And loneliness is something that I've actually studied and looked into for a few years now when I was researching this other book that I wrote called The Mystery of the Lone Wolf Killer. And back in 2011.
I have that book. And do you say in that, do I remember correctly, something like 40% of the world suffers from loneliness? There's some like huge number of people who are lonely.
Yeah. So that was before the pandemic. You know, in the U.S., more than 40% in the U.S., and which basically applies also to at least, you know, the Western world. But now coming out of the pandemic, we're more like, it's more up to 60%, according to the most recent recent numbers. And that is just really, first of all, crazy, not surprising either with the, you know, with the lockdown and you know, everything, you know, shutting down and we're not able to be social. But it's also really scary because when people are lonely, first of all, it's damaging to our health, our mental health and our physical health. And also it makes us dangerous not only to ourselves because of the increased risk of suicide, but it makes us dangerous to others. And just coming out of, you know, just these first few months of 2021 in the U.S., we've seen a rapid increase of mass shootings in the U.S. And I believe there's a correlation there, because when I studied these mass killers, I started studying them in 2011. What I found was that all of them, no matter where they came from, what their upbringing, their education, didn't matter. All of them suffered from loneliness, feeling rejected, excluded from society, distrusting leadership, just, you know, and really searching for belonging. And they, these lone wolves, what happens to them is that they can't really connect even with extremist groups because they're rejected even there. So they go out on their own and then they sort of adopt this hateful ideology, this extremism. So I'm sorry, I'm going off on a rant here, but it's just really close to my heart because I believe, yeah.
It's interesting because like what, if you find yourself lonely and what are steps you can do to not be lonely? Because I imagine loneliness is a problem that could be solved, but maybe people get in this dark cave where they don't have enough light to see their way out of the cave.
Yeah. It's important, first of all, to know what loneliness is and what it isn't. So we can be lonely when we're with other people. We, you know, we're so used to thinking of loneliness as something that is when we are physically separated from other people, or, you know, the elderly, for instance. But that's just not true. And most of the people who are lonely today are actually younger. And so that's really scary. And so, you know, we can have, you know, there are three dimensions of connection that we all need. And so the first one is the intimate or emotional connection. And loneliness in this area is the longing for a partner or typically a spouse. And then the second dimension is the relational connection. That is, loneliness in this area is the yearning for quality friendships. And then we have the collective connection. And this is where I believe the Peace Prize comes in and has an impact. Loneliness here looks like the hunger for a network, community, or a culture even, where you feel that you have a sense of purpose and the same interests. So this is where we are in our world today, that loneliness here is creating a lot of polarization and danger.
Yeah, because I guess if you're not getting the intimate loneliness or the friendships, you sign up for the group. And like whether it's red or blue or some other faction, and you know, you go kind of to the easiest common denominator to solve your loneliness. It's like a natural thing. And I wonder, I guess on the one hand, people have to recognize that it's in themselves. They might not feel lonely because they're going to all these rallies and everyone's having a great time. But I guess it's important to be aware of it, why you might be doing something. Well, you know, and I guess it's related to addiction. Like, you know, alcoholism is a form of, you know, collective community. If you're feeling lonely in other areas of your life. So it's interesting.
Absolutely.
Maybe Mark Zuckerberg should get the Nobel Peace Prize because Facebook's connected certainly a billion people or two. Or maybe disconnected them.
That is true. Although, you know, Facebook has, you know, been used for a lot of atrocities as well. So, it's a two-faced matter. But I think, you know, back to what you asked before, like, what can you do? I think, you know, for anyone who are struggling maybe with, you know, feeling lonely or the yearning for any, you know, sort of type of connection in these three areas, it's important to know that when we say that we're lonely, what we're really saying is that we don't feel that we are worthy of love and connection. And so that unworthiness is important to become aware of and also to start to work on increasing our self-worth. And, you know, that can be done through many things that, the reason also why I'm so fascinated by loneliness is because it's been my journey, my struggle in my life. I mean, you know, one of the reasons that I actually, the main reason why I left Norway as a young woman was because I didn't feel that I belonged in my culture, in my society. I always felt that I was very different and that I wasn't allowed to be who I was and to have the opinions that I had. And so I was searching for a place where I could feel free to be myself and also accepted and recognized and sort of create a sense of belonging there. And much later, of course, I, you know, sort of discovered, you know, the hard way that unless I increased my self-worth, then I would never feel that belonging, because that belonging starts with ourselves first. So however, you know, I use yoga a lot, you know, meditation, also learning to set boundaries, and just by little by little, respecting myself, asking myself in a journal every morning, like, how can I respect myself a little more today? You know, setting boundaries and
that's a good idea to do it in increments. Like, what's one small way someone can respect themselves a little more?
One of my favorite questions is, you know, I ask myself, and this might sound silly, but I ask myself in my journal every morning, it's like, how can I not only respect myself, but how can I love myself more today? And, you know, whatever comes up, I write it down. And it might be that, okay, well, today I need to just lie down for half an hour and not do anything. Or yeah, maybe I need to go for a walk in nature. Or, you know, maybe I need to pet my dog or have a cup of coffee and not drive myself so hard. You know, it can be little things like that. It doesn't have to be huge.
You should write a book of those things. Like all the techniques.
I actually am. And I'm not only writing a book about it. I actually have written a book that is about that. It is also my personal journey. But what I'm doing right now is that I'm creating this online course because, you know, coming out of the pandemic and knowing that so many people are struggling with loneliness, and there's all this shame around loneliness, right? So, because we don't want to talk about it. I mean, it took me forever to admit that I felt lonely, because to me I was such a failure at social connection, you know, and it made me feel like that. So it's only been very recent that I talk about it, but I do think it's important, and I do think it's important for me. It's a way for me to getting over my shame of feeling lonely, and also to contribute, to do something to try to prevent these mass shootings, to try to help other people feel less lonely and make them feel like, okay, we can be part of something. We can be part of something that isn't extremism or a conspiracy theory. We can be part of something just being on a human level, finding, okay, whatever we have in common, or even if we don't have anything on the surface in common, let's get to know each other and build relationships. So I'm creating this online course that I want to, because I want to, I mean, I do talk about, I do, you know, public speaking and that sort of thing and write books, but I wanted to reach more people. So I decided to create this course because that's something that even if we feel ashamed, we can do it, you know, at home in our living room, and nobody needs to know that we're doing this course. And then, from there, you know, enter into a community on Facebook or whatnot. But I was inspired to create this course actually by your book, Skip the Line, because, you know, I was reading it and it was such a great book. I absolutely loved it, because not only is it good for, you know, business and entrepreneurs like me, it's a book about life and how to live a better life, you know, in my opinion. So it really touched me, your book.
Oh, and I appreciate you saying that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Now I feel less lonely.
Exactly. Feel less lonely. And it also, you know, writing about your journey and how you were, you know, struggling with depression and feeling that your friends, you know, left you every time you went bankrupt, you know, and this, I think we all go through on some level periods where we feel alone and lonely, and we wish we had support, and we wish we felt worthy of love and connection. And so I wanted to do that. So I'm creating this course, and I have this free course that I'm giving out first, because it's a smaller one.
What's the website?
So my website is www. And my name, so it's Uni Turretini. I'm going to spell that because it's long. it's UNNITURETINI.com. So it will be there to download for anyone who is interested, and, you know, and hopefully they can share it too with you know, whoever they feel could need it. So. Yeah,
this is great. I'm gonna check this out. And once again, Uni, thank you so much. Also, I really love the book, Betraying the Noble. There's so many great stories. We went over like 1/10 of them, but really interesting stories about the history of the past century and what peace is and who got these awards and why some were wrong and how horrible some of these things were. And I appreciate where this conversation ended up with this discussion of loneliness. Like, when do you think your course will come out?
It will be so the smaller one is ready now. And then the bigger one, hopefully in a couple of weeks. So yeah.
Excellent.
So that will be, yes, absolutely. And you know, and just to circle back to, I think it has to, you know, why the Nobel Peace Prize matter is if they can select winners that are not motivated by the political situation of Norway or some other whim, and instead do the job they're supposed to do and really, you know, just continue Alfred Nobel's, his wish for, you know, unity, freedom, and connection, and then creating this base, this foundation for a more peaceful world, then I think also this loneliness epidemic that we're seeing will also decrease, and people will feel more, you know, that they belong in our society, in our culture.
Right, because it's such an important institution. I mean, it's evolved that way that if you lose trust in it, then that's kind of the first step towards that slippery slope towards extremism, where you stop trusting more and more institutions that you were originally taught to trust. I mean, that's why someone like Bob Dylan, I mean, I know it's a different prize, but he doesn't show up for the Nobel Prize in literature because he just doesn't trust the institution anymore.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people like him who, for them, it's not like a big thing anymore, the Nobel Peace Prize or the Nobel Prize in literature or whatever. So it's definitely an important topic, like how these institutions rise up, but always keeping in mind that they have, many of them have their own internal agendas. And you're right, that could be related to the alienation towards society as a whole. So it is all connected.
And I do believe it's possible to right this ship, at least of the Nobel Peace Prize. I do believe so. I mean, and to do that, they need to stop putting politicians on the committee. I mean, the committee should not be
awarding politicians, probably.
Right? And, you know, and also probably stop rewarding politicians. And also this secrecy, this whole, you know, like secrecy around the Nobel Peace Prize that, you know, they're not supposed to discuss anything, you know, any of the process. Like, we don't know, like, we don't even know who's nominated unless it's leaked, you know, to the press by the people nominating. And so, you know, we, in today's world, today's leadership and culture, we need transparency, right? So I think, you know, I think there are simple steps that the committee can take, right? And also, let's define peace. What is peace? What is what comes in under, what kind of work can fall in, under the peace umbrella? I think it's important to that we all know.
But you know, I've lost faith in the institution. We'll see what happens. Yeah. But I'm glad at the very least your book provides a lot of this transparency, even though it's probably not approved by them, of course. But at least shedding light on the issue might make them more aware and take some of your suggestions, I hope.
I hope so.
Once again, Uni Turrettini, that's Turrettini. I also made the mistake of only having one T when it should have been two T's at the teeny.
Yeah. And there's a lot of double consonants there. Yeah.
Yeah.
So UNITURRETTINI.
Yeah, three double consonants in your whole name. That could be a record.
Yeah.
And the book is, well, the foreword is by Michael Nobel. And the book is called Betraying the Nobel, The Secrets and Corruption Behind the Nobel Peace Prize. And I'm also fascinated by your work on loneliness and looking forward to the course. And your website, again, is www.uniturrettini. Let me see if I can't spell your name. I'm just going to try on Google. I'm going to just type Uni. I'm not going to do the double T's.
I think you'll still find me because I'm the only one in the world with my name. So you'll probably still land on me.
You know, I did UNITURRETTINI, and I don't get you. But maybe if I do two N's, Let's do that. Yes, then I get you right away.
Okay, cool.
The two ends are critical.
The two ends are critical, yes.
Because there's too many things, I guess, like uni means one. So there's too many things with that.
Yeah.
But, okay, well, thanks once again for coming on the podcast. Such an interesting discussion. And I encourage people to read the book because there's a lot more stories and it's just fascinating what has gone into this prize. And hopefully we'll have you on again to talk about loneliness with your new course.
Thank you so much for having me, James. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, same here.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.